You are listening to Free Radio Olympia. Here at the Thunderbolt, I tend to cover a lot of controversial topics from controversial points of view. And therefore, some of the other folks that work with this radio station always appreciate it when I point out that while they may agree with the views expressed on this program, they also very well may not. And in either case, they are in no way responsible for that content. Therefore, if my show makes you want to start hurling blunt objects at people, then make sure you choose the correct target, which in this case would be me, not them. And now, on with the show. All right. Welcome to the Thunderbolt for May Day 2020. So during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, May Day was a day of worldwide worker solidarity. And in fact, the reason that the United States instituted a Labor Day in early September was a largely successful attempt by the elites of the time to blunt and marginalize the power of May Day. Anyway, let us begin this week's show by discussing baseball's infield fly rule. And I wish to begin this week's show by discussing baseball's infield fly rule, because I find that rule to be a solution worthy of Solomon. The infield fly rule assumes the worst of everyone. It disciplines the guilty. It restrains the powerful. And it accounts for the innocents. In this situation, the batter is automatically a schmuck for popping an infield fly whilst there are runners on base, but the infielder isn't allowed to take advantage of the batter's schmuckiness by accidentally dropping the ball so that he can subsequently pick off the more dangerous lead runner rather than merely retiring the less dangerous batter. The infield fly rule states that the schmuck batter is automatically out no matter what, but the potential threat the situation poses to the runners, who themselves had nothing to do with anything, is transformed into the freedom to either risk running or to safely remain on base during the duration of the pop fly, all at their own initiative and all at their own risk. It's only fair, after all. What isn't fair is this newest coronavirus aid package that just breezed through Congress. This is especially so since this new aid package will lead to the largest transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top in all human history, topping even the fiasco of 2007 and 2008.
Whenever I'm with you, something inside.
Well, Nancy Pelosi aggressively pushed this bill through the House with a voice vote, which is a legislative trick they pull out of the hat whenever they don't want anyone to be held accountable in the future for whatever atrocity they are passing right now. Therefore, we don't know how the squad voted on this bill. But all of our new socialist heroes, including Bernie Sanders, were all on the brainwashed box the very next day, praising the good parts of this bill whilst completely ignoring the massive Wall Street giveaway. Ironically, the only congressional criticism I could find of this bill came from a frigging Republican who not only criticized the bill, but he totally nailed it. According to Representative Thomas Massey, a Republican of Kentucky, the stimulus package that just passed is the biggest wealth transfer from the common folks to the super rich or the Wall Street bankers in the history of mankind. Done in the name of a virus with $1,200 checks as the cheese in the trap. And this will be obvious in short order. So that very last sentence caught my interest. It will be obvious in short order. To whom? Sometimes, things that seem as if they should be obvious are veiled behind an impenetrable wall of obfuscation. And speaking of Democrats, my current relationship with the Democratic Party has become a truly rich collection of ironies. Everyone who knows me knows that I loathe the Democratic Party, and yet I am a Democratic Party precinct committee officer. And this came about because over a year before the 2018 election, I let someone register me to run for that position, since it was framed to me as a golden opportunity to poke the corporate Democrats in the eye and to try to take our party back from the warmongers. I figured from the outset that this was a lost cause, but I also figured that a lot of good information would reach the public as a result of such an effort that they would not hear of otherwise. And so I felt the effort itself was worth it, whether or not it succeeded at its stated goals. Anyway, I promptly forgot all about signing up to run for PCO until I went to vote in 2018. And to my utter shock and dismay, I not only saw my own name on my own ballot, but I was listed there as a frigging Democrat. It actually took me several minutes of wondering how in the hell that had ever happened before I vaguely remembered having signed up for that. And I figured that since my anti-Democratic Party stance is widely known in local political circles, then I probably had about an ice cube's chance in hell of ever actually winning any elections as a Democrat anyway. However, in spite of my anti-Dem leanings, or perhaps because of them, I not only won a three-way election, an election that I did not even know I was in, much less one that I campaigned for in any manner whatsoever. But I won that election with a near supermajority. I believe it was 58% or something like that. And so, here I am. Yippee. Why, if I had a level of ambition indicating serious psychological derangement and a willingness to sell my soul to the devil, I might consider running for higher office. The now somewhat muted presidential campaigns do continue, and while this election's relevance to our new reality paradigm is still to be determined, it may be even more important now than ever. I probably overused this analogy, but it is so appropriate that I'm going to use it again. I would literally vote for a cockroach on a Ouija board before I would ever vote for frigging Joe frigging Biden. And I'm pretty sure there are millions of leftists in this country who feel the same way. Because Joe Biden is the very personification of everything that is so very wrong with the current Democratic Party. One of several dozen reasons that the Democrats lost in the last presidential election was because they gave us a business-as-usual candidate at the very same time that the one thing the American voter was making perfectly clear was that business-as-usual was absolutely no longer an option. And now, the Democrats are once again trying not only to shove business as usual down our throats, but this time, they're trying to shove a man who is a total frigging reactionary, warmongering idiot even before he started going senile. Yes, after 3 years of the rump's insanity, a lot of people are likely to be much more ready for business as usual than they were before. But I really don't think it will be enough to win. Joe Biden is so totally vulnerable in so many ways and in so many levels and on so many issues that the rump's main problem will be in choosing at which vulnerability he should aim his yacht in order to sink Joe Biden's seriously overloaded and seriously leaky rowboat. If Biden gets the nod, then the rump is going to start treating him like a frigging pinata. And it is going to be an exceptionally ugly thing to behold. And it is hard to pin down Biden's actual record because he is an habitual liar. Does anyone still remember that Joe Biden's first presidential bid ended in disaster due to his blatant lies? The actual facts are that Joe Biden supports serious restrictions on women's access to abortion. He only recently came out against the Hyde Amendment. But this was only after he supported it since its passage in 1976. Joe Biden wants to cut Social Security, Medicare, and food stamps, even as he enthusiastically supports every interventionist war that comes along. He never asks how we're going to pay for all of those wars, by the way. And in addition, gas company lobbyists dominate the board of Joe Biden's super PAC. The insurance machine has owned Joe Biden for decades. Thus, Joe Biden's adamant opposition to Medicare for all. Joe Biden voted for the 2006 border fence, and Joe Biden was instrumental in vastly expanding the war on drugs. Joe Biden not only voted in favor of the Patriot Act, but he actually authored large parts of it. And he was trying to pass off his version of the Patriot Act in the Senate during Bill Clinton's presidency in the mid-90s. Joe Biden not only supported Bill Clinton's dismantling of the welfare state, and Joe Biden not only supported Bill Clinton's criminalization of an entire generation of black children, but Biden's influence on the key Senate committees was an absolutely necessary component to the passage of both of those bills. It was Joe frigging Biden who eliminated bankruptcy protections for student debtors. And Joe Biden now regularly lies about his role in all of those things. And yet another one of the dozens of reasons that the Democrats lost the last election was because of their passage and support for NAFTA and the TPP. The rump took numerous states in the upper Midwest that had been traditionally Democratic Party strongholds. And that happened because the droves of working class people in the upper Midwest who deserted the Democrats to vote for Donald Trump did so largely because they hate NAFTA with a deep and abiding passion. And justifiably so. When NAFTA and the TPP became politically toxic, then after decades of vocal support, Hillary Clinton suddenly did a 180 degree turn on NAFTA and the TPP during her primary campaign. But her move represented such blatant pandering, and it was so transparently patronizing, that nearly everyone gave Mrs. Clinton's 180 degree turnaround all of the respect that it was due. Joe Biden not only also vociferously supported both NAFTA and the TPP, but again, Biden's influence on the key Senate committee was a necessary component to the passage of both NAFTA and the TPP. And I can guarantee you that NAFTA and the TPP will be one of the largest of the many clubs that Donald Trump is going to use to beat Joe Biden to a freaking pulp. It was the same deal with the Iraqi invasion and occupation. Joe Biden not only loudly supported George Bush's invasion and occupation of Iraq, but again, Biden's influence on the key Senate committee was absolutely vital to that invasion and occupation. And Joe Biden was still aggressively defending the invasion and occupation years after the fact, even though he recently denied that as well. And in what constitutes the richest irony, considering the Rump's own history of abusing women, wait until the Rump invites the American people to watch a video of Joe Biden in 1991 grilling Anita Hill as if Anita Hill were a criminal rather than a brave black female whistleblower.
Dance with me, Mr. Robot.
Who is exposing the fact that their Supreme Court nominee, Clarence Thomas, was a frigging sexual predator. This was during a Senate hearing that was broadcast on national television that was watched by millions. This act destroyed Anita Hill's life, and this act was long before Me Too made such things mainstream. Clarence Thomas, of course, now sits on the Supreme Court. And that truly alarming state of affairs is due in no small part to Joe Biden. And to make things truly maddening, Clarence Thomas sits on that same seat that was once occupied by a frigging Thurgood Marshall, who has surely been spinning in his grave ever since. And as I've been warning all along, the Democratic Party machine was never going to let Bernie Sanders anywhere near that nomination. And even though Bernie has turned his coat and endorsed Joe Biden, it is still very important to keep the hammer down and to keep pushing these a-holes, because more and more people are figuring stuff out these days. And we simply can't allow their war machine to keep getting away with this crap. And we need to extract as much from their shriveled little hearts as we possibly can. And keeping Bernie Sanders' platform in their face would be helpful in doing that. And besides, it's very easy for me to imagine a great big stink bomb exploding right into the middle of Joe Biden's campaign. And if that happens, then let's pray that it happens before the nomination is finalized. And while we can still choose someone else besides some over-the-hill, sold-out, reactionary warmonger and baby killer like frigging Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders comes to mind as a viable alternative, in fact. So anyway, it's getting about time for a station break here. The Thunderbolt will be back in just a few minutes. Hang in there. Yippee. The views expressed on this program are strictly those of the show's producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station nor anyone associated with this radio station. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. Welcome back. You know, I've studied quite a bit of history, and as far as I've been able to determine, Genghis Khan was the only person of color who has ever invaded white people. And I theorize that this is why Genghis Khan never gets the same props or the same laurels as other lesser invaders and empire builders, such as Napoleon, Alexander, and Caesar. Rather than a glorious conqueror and empire builder, Genghis Khan is almost always depicted as a savage, bloodthirsty monster. At one point in American history, the term Mongoloid literally became a racial slur. Genghis Khan has been demonized and diminished in so-called Western culture ever since he first appeared on the scene. Genghis Khan conquered the largest land empire that anyone has ever put together, Romans and British notwithstanding. And unlike all those other empires, Genghis Khan put his thing together in his single lifetime. And the Khanate that Genghis Khan founded lasted in various forms for hundreds of years. Now, Genghis Khan was indeed incredibly savage in battle, and he is mostly known for his habit of wiping out entire populations of entire cities and then burning those cities to the ground without mercy. If they really pissed him off, he would even salt their soil. Yes, guilty as charged. Genghis Khan not only did indeed do all of those things, but he did all of those things, really, a lot. However, here is the thing about Genghis Khan. Unlike any other major conqueror of which I am aware, Genghis Khan almost always gave his opponents a choice. If the besieged city in question simply surrendered and acknowledged the Khan as their sovereign, then nothing else in their lives would change very much. The Khan would station a few troops, and he would justly and fairly charge them a few taxes for the very real protection that those troops offered. He would station a few local officials to keep an eye on things, but otherwise, the locals were not only allowed to keep their lives, but with the understanding that the Khan's officials could overrule them if they felt it necessary, the locals could even keep their local officials and local laws and local practices. Or not, as the case may have been. And not only that, but in addition, they could keep their unburned city, they could keep their unsalted land, and they could keep their unraped wives, and they could keep their unmurdered children, and they could keep their jobs.
Joshua fought the battle of Jericho.
And they could keep
Jericho,
their dignity.
Jericho, hey! Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down.
And they could even keep their religions.
Gideon, you may talk about your man of swole.
For Genghis Khan,
like good old Joshua,
strictly forbade religious persecution
of
any kind.
Jericho, Jericho.
And another unique attribute was that while he had no problem killing thousands of people at a time, Genghis Khan strictly forbade torture. And another practice, almost unique to Genghis Khan, was that he strictly enforced a zero-tolerance policy on the buying, selling, or kidnapping of women. The Khan's own mother had been a kidnap victim, and the Khan himself had grown up as a slave as a result. Thus, if you kidnapped, bought, or sold any woman on the Khan's turf, then the Khan would cut your freaking head off. This practice succeeded at seriously curbing the practice of slavery in the Khan's empire. Now keep in mind, Genghis Khan was almost unique in all of these attributes, both at that time and in all succeeding times until now. And FYI, the only reason the Khan didn't just keep on going into Western Europe was partly because thickly wooded landscapes were not conducive to his form of warfare. But also, because he considered the Western Europeans of the time to be so poor and so pitiful that the con figured they would prove to be more of a liability than anything else, and he thus did not consider them to be worthy of conquering. Anyway, Genghis Khan came to power because a foreign oppressive Buddhist power structure in Mongolia was trying to force convert the local Uyghur Muslims to Buddhism. Then, after winning that battle, Genghis Khan just kept going from there. Genghis Khan thus literally came to power defending religious freedom, and evidently took that concept to heart. He referred to all religions as the fingers of God, and he militantly enforced religious freedom throughout his entire empire for his entire life. And there is evidence that several of the authors of the American Constitution studied the Khan's empire and were thus aware of the religious freedom aspects of that empire, and thus were also aware of the fruits that the practice of enforced religious freedom could produce, such as peace, for one thing. Because that brings us to the final thing about Genghis Khan's empire that he never gets any props for. For you see, once he conquered,
Joshua fought the battle of Jericho.
The lands that fell Jericho, under Genghis Khan's Jericho, dominion,
Joshua fought the battle
subsequently
of Jericho,
experienced true peace for over 100 years.
And the trumpets began to sound. Joshua told the children to shout that morning, and the walls came tumbling down. Joshua fought.
And I believe that historical epic to be the most universal and widespread period of true peace that any large nation has ever experienced since the dawn of civilization. And keep in mind that they maintained peace in an empire that extended from the Pacific Ocean to Eastern Europe and included most of the Middle East.
And the walls came tumbling down.
What's this? What am I doing?
No wars. No conquerors pillaging and plundering and raping and killing. The Khans strictly forbade all such things, and you messed with the Khans
and the lamb ram sheep
at your own risk.
And the trumpets began to sound. Joshua told his children to give a shout, and the walls came a tumbling down.
In the case of Eastern Europe and the Middle East, regular invasions, burnings, and killings had traditionally been endured by nearly every other generation for millennia, and serious oppression of all common people was pretty much the universal norm nearly everywhere. Yep, peace for over 100 years must have been a very nice break for all those people.
Hey, look, it's Junior!
Hey, Junior!
Hi!
So what all this means is that Genghis Khan was a prince of peace, he was a defender of women's rights, and he was the father of religious freedom. Yes, the history books apparently got it right. This dark-skinned barbarian obviously had no understanding of modern civilization. In the early 70s, I spent a few months in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Joshua hit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua hit the battle of Jericho. The walls came tumbling down, hallelujah.
Now this was shortly after the mafia Jericho, had been run out of town. And while I was there, I heard more than one local complain that without mafia management, the casinos had gone to shite and that the streets were always full of trash. Conditions that the mafia would have never put up with. Yeah, the mafiosi were a bunch of psychopathic murderers, thieves, and malefactors. But at least they ran a high-class game, and at least they kept the streets clean.
Up to the walls of Jericho, with sworn drawn in his hand. Go blow them hogs like Joshua, the battle is in my hand. Joshua, the battle of Jericho.
If your dictator is benevolent, then sometimes people prefer them, because often they can actually get things done. The thing is that benevolent dictators are a very rare breed. That's it for the news and commentary this week. It's time to get to work. All right. So once again, I have some music to fill in the rest of the hour for everyone. And this week, I'm going to focus on really weird but really good cover songs. This is the Moog Cookbook. That was a fun band I discovered a couple years ago called Moog Cookbook, doing Hotel California before that was Born to be Wild. We'll see you next week. The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way, is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt. Nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com. And we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day. And please note that the Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes. Or you can now go directly to the Thunderbolt WordPress site, which is at dana98501.wordpress.com.
Thank you very much.